This is the RightsCast Network, brought to you by Dandelion Web Marketing, the Wisconsin Writers Association, and the University of Wisconsin Writers Institute, and always streaming at rightscast.net. The winner of this month's critique of their manuscript's first five pages is Steve Fox. Steve, you lucky son of a gun. You became a patron not that long ago. You're our newest patron, in fact, and you have already won one of our monthly drawings for a critique of your manuscript's first five pages. So congratulations to you, Steve, and listeners at home. If you aren't yet a patron, Steve here is representative of what can happen if you sign up and show your support for the RightsCast Network at patreon.com/rightscast. Aside from being entered in these monthly drawings for a critique of your first five pages, you can get access to some great patron perks, including RightsCast Network swag, listening to every one of these episodes early and ad-free, and tons of other great patron rewards. So head on over to patreon.com/rightscast. Now, unless of course you're driving, don't do it now, then wait until you're home and safe and not on your phone. But patreon.com/rightscast is the place to be to get in on these monthly drawings. Congratulations again to Steve. I'll be in touch soon and we will make it happen for your manuscript's first five pages. All right, on with the show. This is episode 24 of Novel Approaches here on the RightsCast Network. Welcome to the RightsCast Network's Novel Approaches podcast, a craft-focused conversation for writers everywhere.
Because writing novels is hard, and we're all in this together.
Hey there, I'm author, writing coach, and Wisconsinite who is so ready for spring, R.R. Campbell.
And I'm Angeline Bulley, author and guest co-host of the Novel Approaches podcast.
In this installment of Novel Approaches, brought to you by Dandelion Web Marketing, the Wisconsin Writers Association, and the University of Wisconsin Writers Institute, we'll be breaking down opening lines, what we ought to strive for in them, what we ought to avoid, and how we can use them to hook readers from the first words of our manuscripts, scenes, and chapters. But first, Angeline, thank you for joining me as a guest co-host. How are things going for you writing-wise?
Well, it's funny you should ask, because today is a deadline for me, and it's my first round one deadline to my editor. I'm not sure how this turned out to record the podcast on the day of a deadline, but I'm here.
And I certainly appreciate you making time. I know that deadlines can be rather nerve-wracking, but it sounds like you've recently transitioned into being a full-time writer. And I know from previous conversation, it sounded like that was going pretty well so far, right?
Yes, it's going very well. And I'm just thankful to Sion for connecting us. I worked with Sion on my manuscript before I had my agent. And she really helped shape things up. And I'm in awe of her, really. So I've heard great things about you. I've listened to the podcasts. And so I'm really happy to be here today. And for the audience that does not know me, my name is Angeline Bulley. And I'm a tribal member from the Sault Ste. Marie tribe of Chippewa Indians, but I live and work now in Washington, D.C. I used to work in Indian education, and now I am a full-time author. I am working on my debut novel, which was acquired at auction by Holt, which is an imprint of Macmillan. And my novel is called Firekeeper's Daughter, and it is set to publish in March of 2021. So that's what's going on with me.
That was going to be my next question, and we are officially in March 2020 now, so the timer is counting down 365 days to go, you know? So I actually am really excited about your novel. I had the chance to see the listing in Publishers Weekly, and it seems really fascinating, and given your background, you are certainly the right person to be telling this story, it seems. So I'm very much looking forward to it. If pre-orders were up, I would already have mine pre-ordered.
Thank you so much.
And I'm really grateful as well that Sion, who was the co-host of the Novel Approaches podcast regularly for quite a while, recommended that you and I work together on an episode. I've been looking forward to this one for quite a while, so we'll dive in just a moment. But first, I wanted to share a couple things from my corner of the writing world as well. I did finish a manuscript recently. This one is, Sion and I actually talked about this one a couple episodes back. It takes place on a cranberry farm in northern Wisconsin. Really, I think, neat upmarket suspense with a speculative twist. And coming up here soon, some conference appearances. Folks, if you're a regular WritesCast Network listener, you know that the University of Wisconsin Writers Institute is coming up. I'll be doing some sessions there on conflict and setting. I'll also be doing some one-on-one coaching and pitching one of my manuscripts. So yeah, a lot going on in my corner of the world too, though I'm not on deadline, and I know that you are. So let's not dawdle. Let's power right into our conversation. Thanks to our listeners who are listening in right now, and of course to the folks who joined us for our WritesCast chats over on Instagram and Twitter. If this is your first time listening to this program, the way that it works is we take to the internet and we ask you, our listeners, what you think about opening lines, and then we bring that feedback into our episode. Myself and our co-host, we react to that, we kind of break it all down, we analyze it, and then we take some of your questions at the end. So with that in mind, we actually wanted to open up today by asking listeners what some of their favorite opening lines were. And over on Twitter, Jennifer Worrell, who tweets at jworrellwrites, had this to say: one of Jenny's favorite lines comes from Lighthouse Keeping by Jeanette Winterson, and the line is this: my mother called me silver. I was born part precious metal, part pirate. All right, that one definitely, you know, that's a good opener, I think. I don't know, Angeline, does that one strike any questions for you?
Yes, there's an immediate question. Why part metal? Why part more interesting is more part pirate. What is going on with that?
And I think that that's something that's going to be at the heart of this conversation, is trying to raise questions with opening lines, right? So thank you to Jenny for that recommendation. And then Angeline, we have here next, it looks like, a tweet from Whitney Hill, right?
Sure. And Whitney Hill at @write_wherever, her favorite opening line is from The City of Brass: he was an easy mark. And she says it's short, but immediately intriguing. And I agree.
Yeah, I really like this idea of opening with a short, simple, declarative sentence. I know that for me personally, in my published fiction and also in the manuscripts that I have been working on in the background here for future publication, that's always my strategy, is open up with that quick, punchy declarative, make sure that it gets people, you know, asking questions, and then hopefully entices them to read and meets that criteria of being intriguing, as Whitney has said here.
Yes. And on the flip side of that, though, we should acknowledge Sion's favorite book, or one of her favorite books, from Pride and Prejudice. It is a truth universally acknowledged that a single man in possession of a good fortune must be in want of a wife.
Sion has definitely referenced that in past episodes. Pride and Prejudice is a big one for Sion, that's for sure.
Mm-hmm.
And that really sets the stage as well, I think, and is another thing that is worth invoking in an opening line. And that's great, because we're going to be talking next about what's important in an opening line. But in this example from Pride and Prejudice, we're also getting at what theme, which is also a really great thing to try and start invoking in an opening line, whether it's theme or the central question of one's manuscript. It's certainly something worth striving for, and we see that very much in Pride and Prejudice, as a good example there from you via Sion.
Yes.
All right, well then let's talk about that in some detail. What's important in an opening line and what we should strive to include? I've gone ahead and answered that question for myself, but we of course had feedback from folks in our WritesCast chat over on Twitter and Instagram. I've got a couple of Instagram posts here, as well as a tweet that all kind of got at the same idea. These are from Fable and the Verbivore over on Instagram, who said this: I like when opening lines provoke some question in me, particularly why questions. That doesn't mean I want to be thrown right into suspense or action with the first lines. The questions can be subtle, but I want the first lines to intrigue me with some uncertainty and draw me in. Very similarly, Maggie Smith Wright said this: must be compelling, well-phrased, and raised a question. And Whitney Hill, who, as you mentioned, Angeline, tweets at @write_wherever, said that as a reader, I love when an opening line makes me go, ooh, what's that about? And Whitney also adds that she prefers shorter opening lines, as we were kind of getting at before. So a lot of really great stuff here. And what I like in particular about this post from Fable and the Verbivore is that the opening line, the question, can be really subtle. And I think that there's something to be said for that subtlety. Wouldn't you agree, Angeline?
I would agree. However, some of our participants have a contrasting thought, though. So Brianna Morgan Books writes, I'm a sucker for opening lines that convey the main character's voice. Sarah Smith at author Sarah S. writes, something that grabs my attention. That's a pretty vague statement, I know, but honestly, as long as it hooks me, I don't really care what it is. I do try to do this as a writer. It's tough, though. A good first sentence is difficult to craft, in my opinion. And we have a bit of a devil's advocate here with Glenn Quigley, at Gwen Quigley, who writes, I think we put too much pressure on first lines. If anything, I think first paragraphs are more important, or even first pages.
Yeah, and why don't we explore that for a moment, actually, because I do think that Glenn raised a really good point as part of that WritesCast chat that we also host now, not only at 8 p.m. Eastern Time, but we host it at 8 p.m. Greenwich Mean Time. We host it at 8 p.m. Australian Eastern Standard Time. We're doing it worldwide now, but Glenn joined us over in the UK. So thanks, Glenn, for raising that point. And I'm curious to know, Angeline, we've had a few different comments here for approaches to opening lines. Some folks talking about whether maybe it's the whole first paragraph or the first page that should really be the focus of our attention. With The Firekeeper's Daughter, what was your approach to the opening line, paragraph, or page, if there was something really deliberate that you had going on in your head as you started writing that?
Well, my story is set in my tribal community. And in Ojibwe teachings, all journeys begin in the eastern direction. So my first sentence is, I start my day before sunrise, throwing on running clothes and laying a pinch of sema at the eastern base of a tree where sunlight will touch the tobacco first. That was just to kind of set the tone for how the story begins.
It sets the tone, yes, and it also is raising another question, and that's that important question at the heart of what some of which has been said here by those who participated in our chat, and that is, why? You know, why is this being laid out facing east? Why is it important that the tobacco be touched first as the sun rises from the east? And those questions tie directly into the background of your main character in a really big way. So you are setting the stage, as you have said, and I'm sure that as we advance down the first page and beyond, we start getting more of a framing, a broader exploration of the context in which this story is taking place. And it's all building on that opening line, kind of like Glenn says. It's not just that opening line, it's that first paragraph and first page that's just as important as well.
I agree. And so does Maggie Smith writes. She wrote, yes, the opening of the novel has to be compelling, raise a question. The opening sentence in the chapter and scene needs to quickly orientate the reader about where they are in the story, i.e. setting and time. Its job is to ground the reader so they are propelled into the scene, but know where they are at.
And that's exactly right. And I'm thankful that Maggie was able to share that with us because, of course, the second question that we wanted to tackle today was this notion of whether an opening line for a manuscript is different than the opening line for a chapter or a scene. And in this case, as our conversation expands beyond the opening line, what needs to go in that opening paragraph? What needs to go in that opening page, whether that's for the manuscript itself or for a new chapter? And one thing also that was sort of a contrasting opinion was also shared on Twitter by S.J. Whitby. S.J. Whitby writes is where they tweet, and they had this to say, for them, opening lines don't make or break a book. I do like a sense of voice and a sense of humor in an opening line, which I do strive for, or at least, again, here we're getting a mention of the opening paragraph. So some really great feedback coming in from folks like Maggie, from people like S.J. Whitby, and of course, again here, from Whitney Hill, who we, you know, answering this question of what's the difference between an opening line for a manuscript? What's the difference between that and a new chapter? Whitney said this, for Whitney, there's not really a different approach at all. The point is to just keep people reading when you're at key points like beginnings and endings. The only difference for me is the importance of a logical transition. And does that ring true for you, Angeline?
I agree. I think that the first sentence or the first paragraph, for sure, I think there has to set an expectation for the reader. And there has to be a point. There has to be, I believe, something that it makes you feel something, whether it's intrigue or disgust or hope. I think that it's important for that first sentence to set the tone for your story. And again, with chapter openings, I like it when it asks a question and it pulls you in, and it because a lot of times when you're reading and you get to the bottom of a page and you turn the next page, if that first line pulls you in, then, you know, that's an all night of reading, and I don't want to stop until I finish, till I turn the last page.
This episode is brought to you by Dandelion Web Marketing. Dandelion Web Marketing helps writers like you build a thriving author platform through strategic web marketing. If you're not sure if you're on the right track with your website, you can get an author website audit and find out. Listeners to the RightsCast Network right now, just you, yes, you listeners here for the RightsCast Network, you can get 50% off one of these author website audits. That's 50%. This audit will look at your site's content, security, design, search engine optimization, and more, and it will provide you with insights on what you might do to improve your connection with your audience. So to learn the strengths and weaknesses of your current website and get half off along the way, you can visit dandelionwebmarketing.com/rightscast to learn more. That's dandelionwebmarketing.com/rightscast. Right. And what I really like about what you're saying there is, again, we're returning to this idea of raising a question. Yes, but we also can get some bonus points, and we're also more likely to bring people into the next chapter if we can invoke some sort of emotion. I know, for an example, you gave something like disgust, or we might have amazement, or just continuing to string them along with this sense of curiosity or wonder or fear or whatever the case might be. And that is a really important thing to try and couple in there as well, because you can raise questions for readers all day, but if they're questions that readers aren't able to feel, if they are questions that don't feel relevant to the main thrust of the story, or they're not necessarily relevant to the scene you're about to present, well, that lack of relevance is going to eventually kind of break down the trust between the reader and between the writer. And when we see that trust break down, it is my experience as a reader who has had his trust betrayed, it's my experience that those books get closed or thrown out of windows, but not actually, because I don't advocate throwing things anywhere where you can't see where it's going to land.
Along the lines of invoking a response, so one of my favorite is Stephen King from It. So the first line of that is, "The terror, which would not end for another 28 years, if it ever did end, began, so far as I know or can tell, with a boat made from a sheet of newspaper floating down a gutter swollen with rain."
Now that is some impactful stuff, right? What is it that draws you to that line so much?
Just that you're just left wondering what, and that's enough to keep going. And then something that I think probably the most compelling first line is Toni Morrison from Paradise. "They shoot the white girl first. With the rest, they can take their time." I mean, what?
Right.
I just think that that first sentence can make such an impact.
It really does make an impact. And what I like about both of these opening lines is that they are, yes, raising questions. Yes, they are invoking emotion. But also, particularly in the Stephen King example, we have this imagery being drawn in that is also worth asking questions about in the first place. There's this idea of the boat that goes down, you know, it's in the gutter, in the water, for example. And then I'm getting in my head for this other example, this idea of, I don't know, there's a firing squad. I'm imagining, you know, people strapped with assault rifles, etc. Even though none of that is said, that those images are being invoked provides enough of a response within the mind's eye that, coupled with those questions and coupled with the emotion, we're in a really powerful position now, both as writers and as readers, to ensure that we're building that trust and keeping people reading along.
Sure. And Jennifer Worrell at J. Worrell writes, she says of chapter openings that maybe chapter openings are slightly easier because they somehow have to flow from what came before, even if it's indirect. It's hard balancing the amount of transitory exposition. Cold openers, though, you could start anywhere.
And do you find that's the case in your writing, Angeline? Is it often easier for you to settle on or to arrive at a chapter opener compared with, say, the very first line of a manuscript?
Well, you have a lot more practice doing the chapter opening.
That's
so
true.
Hopefully with practice comes, you know, the craft improves. I think that one thing that I learned is that when I wrote chapters, I used to write them more like an episode of something. And so there was the beginning and then the climax and then an ending. And what I learned is that by starting and ending my chapter midway through the scene, it provides the opportunity to end on, leave someone hanging, and then the very next line has to stand on its own yet bridge what you just left. And so I've really been trying to work on that, on first sentences of a chapter.
Right. And it sounds like we're getting at the idea of connectivity and, again, returning to the notions of relevance and context as well, because a cliffhanger, if we're going to rely on the classic idea of a cliffhanger at the end of a scene or a chapter, they are certainly effective, but they become, I feel, more effective when we can pick up in the next chapter or in, say, the next scene confidently with this notion that, okay, we built ourselves half of a bridge at the end of the previous chapter. It's time to start letting our readers continue on that same bridge, assuming we're in, say, I don't know, a single point of view narrative where we're not necessarily jumping from one character to the next. We're picking up right away with where we were before and ensuring that, all right, I made a promise to you that we were going to get some action at the end of that chapter. Let's open up by fulfilling that promise right away here again.
Right. It would be really frustrating to jump from the end of that, or to be at the end of that precipice, and then on the next page, the next chapter is a time leap 2 months forward, and you're like, wait, what happened? And you know, just keep reading and you'll find out what happened. No, I want to know now.
Yeah, that's of course very true, with the only, I think, exceptions in my mind being when you're writing in the space of perhaps some nonlinear storytelling, where maybe the thrust of the story is that you are meant to, as a reader, be challenged to assemble the pieces over the course of time, or maybe in a multi-perspective storytelling world where, like, for example, in my Empathy sci-fi saga, you're going to end perhaps with Chandra, our art school dropout, imperiled at the end of a particular chapter. And then we're going to pick up with Wyatt, who is another one of our perspective characters. He's in a nearby place, but we're going back just a little bit in time, and we're going to see what Wyatt was up to in the moments leading up to that. And then after Wyatt's chapter, maybe we get back to Chandra right away, or we stick with Wyatt and we see what happens to Chandra through Wyatt's eyes. The important thing is that we eventually get that connectivity, because if you stretch it for too long, if, like in your example, Angeline, if it's the case that, well, just 2 months passed and you find out what happened after the fact in, say, narrative summary, we're undercutting that suspense. And we're, again, breaking down that pivotal bond of trust that we want to be building with our readers.
Right. The author really has to finely hone their craft to be able to carry that reader along. And so it sounds like you have really worked on your craft to be able to do that in working with multiple points of view and jumping from one character to another, that you really work to master how to keep that reader still engaged with the one character while they're also immersed with another character.
Right. And I think that, you know, for me, the sort of anchor to which I always return are the ideas of creating momentum, of course, raising questions, and ensuring that we have context and connectivity. I think that I can already tell we're halfway through this episode. Those are going to be my takeaways. So spoiler alert for everyone out there, but those are the big words for me. So after having, you know, here explored what it is that we're looking for in an opening line, and then how maybe these opening lines from manuscripts contrast with those of our chapters, why don't we slide now into this idea of what it is we might avoid in an opening line. And we have another tweet here from our friend Jenny at J. Worrell Writes on Twitter. Jenny had this to say, "I love a good twisty sentence, but not as an opener. I often read on the train ride to work, meaning uncaffeinated, LOL, nope," she says. So yes, the idea here is that in an opening line, maybe keep it short. If we get too long and there's too many ideas to keep track of, that might become tough to stick with. Though, you did give us an example, Angeline, that runs counter to this, and that was that Stephen King example. That was a rather long sentence, but it remained powerful. So maybe there's something worth considering there insofar as this particular critique is concerned.
Right. And Whitney Hill at @write_wherever, she writes, "Must not be boring, a thing that might be everyday life with no tension or overly long." And she also said, you know, being super long and complex, attention spans are short these days. I read to escape, and if the opening line feels like work to parse or process, I'm working, not escaping. Take some tips from web marketing copy or use an app like Hemingway to gauge complexity.
Yeah, and what I like about that is that Whitney is saying we don't have to be alone in this, right? One thing that I know historically we've always returned to on this show is the idea of working with or enlisting beta readers to get feedback. But sometimes we might want more immediate feedback, and if something like complexity is a concern, well, Whitney has a suggestion here. You know, think like you're writing web marketing copy and strip it down just to see what the core ideas are at the heart of your line. It's not like we want our opening lines to read like web marketing copy, but there might be some good lessons to be borrowed there. Or even using an app like Hemingway could be a really great way to ensure that we're not doing one of those, all right, it's time for a sentence with 19 sub clauses. Strap in, folks, because you got to be up for a challenge if you're going to stick with me here.
Sure. And, you know, I think that it all depends on the author and their ability to perfect their craft. And really, you know, there are instances where that long opening sentence really is exactly what's needed, and a short one wouldn't do it justice. And the opposite is true also. I think it takes the author to understand which situation calls for what.
And I really do agree with that, actually. I mean, I know that my goal personally is to keep it short and simple for people to set the stage and to bring them in right away. But also, to your point, yes, there are plenty of authors out there. We had the example from It with Stephen King. I can think of an author like Mohsin Hamid, though I can't recall what the opening line to Exit West is. But throughout that book, there were times where I would stop to count the number of words in a sentence. And I recall specifically that there is a 114-word sentence in that book. But even though it is a crowded space, the way that these sentences are crafted to move you from one idea to the next, and they're written with such this great deliberate intensity, and the ideas flow smoothly right down the line, well, a 114-word sentence from someone like Mohsin Hamid works really well. A 114-word sentence from yours truly means that I think I have some editing to do. So it's just a study in contrast.
Right. I'd like to say another one of my favorite first lines that actually is complex, and it's From the Fault in Our Stars by John Green. Late in the winter of my 17th year, my mother decided I was depressed, presumably because I rarely left the house, spent quite a lot of time in bed, read the same book over and over, ate infrequently, and devoted quite a bit of my abundant free time to thinking about death.
And that, I don't know how many words were there. I could have tried to count along the way. Because once you mentioned that book, I was like, that one does have a rather long opener, doesn't it? So again, a testament to how these rules are made to be broken. And that is actually something that Jessica Payne said over on Twitter at JessicaBlueWRI1, said that I can't think of any things that should be avoided in an opening line because, as Jessica adds, I think of the crazy character or writer who would break the rule and how appealing that might be. It's that whole rules are made to be broken thing. So John Green gives us an example. Stephen King gives us an example. Mohsin Hamid. We've got examples for days that run contrary to some of what, at least I know I anyway, attempt to invoke in an opening line by keeping it short and simple.
Right. I think that long first line works good as the book opening, but I think that if you were to repeat that technique in multiple chapters, that's where I think that it wouldn't resonate with the reader. I think it'd be much harder to keep your reader engaged in the book with that repetitive, lengthy opening.
If you're a longtime RightsCast Network listener, I'm sure you've heard me tell you that I start every day at 5:15 with a nice cup of coffee and hammer out my words for the morning. And, well, I've got a new coffee that I am trying out and I am loving it. And that coffee is from 421 Brewhouse. How did I stumble into 421 Brewhouse? Well, they were kind enough to send me a sample of their artisanal coffee that is packaged in unique bags that are aware of the environmental impact the coffee industry can have. This bag is completely unique in the world of coffee. It's a stand-up, reusable Ziploc pouch. That's right, it's reusable. When you're done with the coffee inside, you can keep using that bag, and it holds up really nicely, actually. Better than I expected, anyway. But enough about the bags, because you're not going to drink the bag. That's not how bags work. You're going to drink the coffee, and I've been trying out their Mountain Mist. I really love it. It's fantastic, and on every one of these bags is a unique design highlighting the importance of sustainability, and that's something I love. As someone who has been using the same belt since 2006, I'm not one to just go buy new things willy-nilly. I really want to make sure that I'm acting as sustainably as possible, and my belt has the wear and tear to demonstrate that. But anyway, the time has come for you, too, to try 421 Brewhouse Brews. Look at that, Dr. Seuss. The time has come to try 421 Brewhouse. Go ahead and find 421 Brewhouse on the net. Those are the numbers 421 Brewhouse, and you can visit their Shopify page where you can get a bag for yourself and use coupon code RightsCast at checkout to save yourself some cash. Again, that's 421 Brewhouse. Use coupon code RightsCast. Start acting sustainably, drinking sustainably, writing sustainably. 421 Brewhouse. Yeah, I would see that being the case as well. And I think that sort of plays into this idea of being aware of the rhythm of our prose in general. I know that for people who are listening to this podcast and who also listen regularly to all of the programming on the RightsCast Network, I closed out January of 2020 with one of the first Biblio Breakdown episodes in maybe since 2018. And that entire episode was about paying attention to the rhythm and flow of the words on the page, because I think you are right, Angeline. There is this idea that, well, sure, we have seen examples that suggest we can open with a nice, long, flowing, artfully crafted sentence, but if every one of our sentences has this flow where we go from one to the next and it all starts to sound the same, where will we go? What will we see? We are now hypnotized, falling asleep. Like, we want to actually try and break it up once in a while, see if we can't get the prose to maybe match the action on the page, and that'll go a really long way, whether we're talking about opening lines or we're talking about final lines or all of, you know, the other really important lines in between all of that.
Sure, I agree. And I think that my takeaway is work on craft and try different things. You know, vary your opening sentences in multiple chapters and see what works. There might be situations where, you know, keeping it short is best or throwing in a lengthy one. I think that's the beauty of writing and rewriting, is trying things in, you know, different points of view, different tenses, different openings. That's kind of the art and the craft of writing. And so I admire writers that really push it. I'm fascinated by it.
And I really like the suggestion you've given us here of being willing to try in, say, different tenses or with different points of view, because that rings incredibly true to me right now as someone who, back in November, decided to take another run at a manuscript. This is the Cranberry manuscript I mentioned at the top of the episode. I decided I would take another run at that. This is a manuscript that I think I started in 2017. It has already been through a number of different iterations. At one point, it was offered a contract for publication that I turned down because I decided I wasn't happy with the story and also kind of the contract. But that's beside the point. The point here is, though, that in November, I start working on this manuscript again, and I get about 5 chapters in, and I go, you know what? The narrative mode still is not correct. And so I took what was something written in the third person past, following a single character's point of view, and I rewrote it in the present with an omniscient point of view that kind of glides from one character to the next over the course of, you know, every sentence or chapter or paragraph, what have you. And what that did, not only for the opening line of the book, the opening page of the book, really, which underwent a major overhaul because I realized there was this new power here. What that did for the manuscript, though, and I'm glad it worked out this way and not the other way around, but this feels like the best version of it yet. So being willing to take those risks, even if it means, you know, redoing every sentence to get it in a new point of view or tense, it could prove worth it, and you're never going to know unless you try.
I'm glad that you share that example. Tommy Orange, his book There, There, he writes 12 different characters, and they're all in different, they, you know, they each have their own voice. And so some of the, one chapter is in second person point of view, which is a very difficult thing to do effectively. And, you know, so the first sentence in each of those chapters, it's a new character, it's a new voice, it might be a new tense, and immediately it needs to pull you into that character that is distinct from the chapter that you just ended. And I think it's a masterpiece.
And there really is something to be said for pushing the boundaries a little bit, because you mentioned this use of the second person, and that is very rare and, as you say, very hard to do well. But another thing that we might consider using to open our books or to open our chapters or even just to sprinkle in here and there if we want to keep folks on their toes, as long as, you know, we're doing it with purpose, would be to invoke that sort of epistolary opener. And a book that I can think of that does that actually is David Mitchell's Cloud Atlas, where you're actually reading out of the journal of an individual who was at sea in the 1800s doing some island hopping in what feels like the Pacific, if memory serves. And that's a really interesting way to open up, because it's written in this way where you're meant to be challenged, to piece together what the important details are going to be. And in fact, the first, 12th of the book is written in this very epistolary style, as is the final 12th of the book. And it makes it really engaging because, all right, you get through this first 12th and then suddenly you switch to a more traditional narrative style. You have more questions raised. You slowly start to see the connectivity between what you just read and what you're reading now. And if it's not written in that epistolary voice, who knows how that book reads otherwise? So the idea of experimenting, definitely worth keeping in mind.
Yes.
All right. So I think we're ready to slide into our listener questions for this episode. But before we get to that, I do just want to remind listeners that the WritesCast Network is supported in part by listeners like you. We're supported, of course, through our WritesCast chats on Twitter and Instagram, but we do have people who support us financially at patreon.com/WritesCast. And in exchange for that support, well, those patrons get some really neat perks like WritesCast Network swag, discounts on my writing coach services. There's a fun raffle for a critique of your first 5 pages that I do before every Novel Approaches episode each month. And, you know, you get exclusive, early, ad-free access to every episode of our programming. So you can contribute at $1, $2, or $3 per episode or even per month. Everything counts, and we're really close to unlocking a fourth podcast every month with your support. So again, that's patreon.com/rightscast.
Yes, and we'd especially like to thank Laura Hazen, whose contributions at the Wise Mentor level earns her shout-outs in every RightsCast Network episode, on top of all the other great patron rewards she receives. So, miigwech. Thank you, Laura.
There it is. Yes, thank you, Laura. And Laura was, in fact, the winner of last month's, or maybe it was 2 months ago, first five-page critique. But Laura is also an editing client of mine, so we just tacked on an extra 5 pages to the session we were working on. So it all comes full circle. Take advantage of the discounts. Get that extra 5 pages in there. So thank you very much, Laura. We appreciate your support. But you're here, folks, of course, for the questions that you asked us in our RightsCast chat. And Jenny Worrell, again, Jenny, very popular in this episode. Thanks for your input and for your question here. Jay Worrell writes, asked us this. How do you know when an opening line is good enough to catch an agent's attention? And Angeline, as an agented author, is it possible to ever really know whether it's good enough?
Oh, it's such murky waters. What might appeal to one agent might not appeal to another. I think the answer is it good enough to catch a reader's attention? You know, the looking at the target, what your target audience is, and, you know, sharing your first chapter with some readers in that demographic and just seeing if they're like, whoa, I want to read more. Or are they like, oh yeah, that's a good start. I think that what pulls at a reader is going to pull at an agent as well.
I would agree with that wholeheartedly. I think that it is a great aspiration to want to keep in mind what it is that might catch an agent's eye, but I think you are 100% of the right mind to think about it in terms of, well, what's going to catch a reader's mind, and specifically that reader in our target audience? Because if we can have a connection with our target audience, because by and large, I would have to imagine that we like to write the things that we like to read. So what is it that we would want to see in an opening line when we're reading the genre that we're writing in? And if we can go ahead and keep that on the page, well, an agent who is presumably looking for work in the genre that you are submitting, they might be interested in that then as well. And ta-da, we have accomplished what we set out to do. So that would kind of be my thought on it as well.
Yes. And our next question comes from C.M. Clark, who at CM Clark Writer, and they write, should a character's names be used in the opening lines?
Yeah, this is a good question. When I saw this come up, I immediately went, well, yes, of course. But then I thought, okay, I wonder if there is some, you know, hashtag writing advice out there that is for some reason suggesting maybe it shouldn't be, or we should feel like we don't need to wedge it into the page, so to speak. If it's not where we want to start, maybe it's not where we have to start with a name, for example. And Angeline, I'm thinking back now to the first opening line of The Firekeeper's Daughter. Do you invoke your character's name in that line?
No, I don't.
Okay, yeah, see, there you go. And going back to the question we had prior to that, it was still enough to get an agent's attention, was it not? And so there you have it. You don't always need to invoke that name.
I think, though, one really great example is from Leigh Bardugo with Six of Crows. Her opening line was, Juiced had two problems, the moon and his mustache. Well, just that name, Juiced, I mean, you know, to me, that's worth, you know, continuing to read just to find out more about this character. So, you know, I think that, listen, for every writer podcast out there, for every writer's class that's out there, there are rules and there are things that the industry seems to like right now. And then there's always something else. there's always something that comes along that's like, oh, you don't like to use first reader name or character names in the first sentence. I'll give it to you as the first word, you know. And so I just think that that comes into the craft of the author.
Right. And it's all about knowing what's best for your manuscript. You know, when I think about the books that I have published, I know that in Imminent Dawn, well, the opening line is, Chandra didn't kill her wife, but she may as well have. And okay, Chandra, we have a name in our opening line. This is our character. But then if we transition over to Accounting for It All, the opening line to that book is just, Thursdays are my favorite days at Pornucopia. No opening line. There is a name that is invoked, but we don't know our main character's name yet. And we actually don't until they start engaging with people around their workplace. And I think about my works in progress, you know, this Cranberry manuscript. The opening line to that one is Zachary Carmichael is going to die. And all he's left with are questions. Yes, it's very melodramatic, but wow, it's meant to raise some questions. And there's certainly a character name in that one, right? So it's all about, what is it that you're trying to accomplish? Who do you need on the page? What ideas do you need on the page? And what's the tone you're trying to set, right? So I think that it's not a bad question to ask, but I think that if we start focusing maybe on that too much, to your point, Angeline, we start getting buried in the what is right advice. And I'm not sure that's always the best question to be asking.
Sure. I'll just leave with one other example. How does one describe Artemis Fowl? Various psychiatrists have tried and failed. And, you know, that's the opening line in Artemis Fowl, and his name is on the book, and it's in the first sentence, and it certainly does create an expectation of who is this person, and why have these various psychologists failed at describing him?
RightsCast Network listeners, I've got news for you. The 72nd annual Jade Ring Contest is now taking submissions. Yes, that's right. You can submit to the Wisconsin Writers Association's 72nd annual Jade Ring Writing Contest in the categories of fiction, nonfiction, and poetry. In each category, first, second, and third place will be awarded, as will three honorable mentions, and the winners of their respective categories will have their work featured in Wisconsin People and Ideas magazine, as well as Creative Wisconsin Literary Journal. There are also cash prizes and the coveted Jade Ring available to winners as well. So if you are sitting on some short fiction, if you've got a piece of nonfiction, if you've got some poetry that you would like to submit, head on over to wiwrite.org/contests to learn more and to submit your work. Thanks for listening and best of luck. Yeah, and those again, we're getting back to this idea of questions, right? What questions can we raise and what questions do we want to have raised on the part of readers? Do we want them to be wondering what the character's name is or who they are? What do we want to sort of shine the light on? If we have a little flashlight, what do we want to have within that light and what do we want to have just outside the scope of the light that they're going to want to read on to see if we start giving them some of that as well? So yeah, that's, I think we can call it a wrap on the idea of names anyway, but we have, of course, a couple more questions here. One of those comes from our friend Whitney Hill at @write_wherever, and Whitney asks this: what are some ways to snowball from a good opening line to a gripping first paragraph or page? I love this question. It ties into something that Glenn suggested a little earlier. It's not always just about that first line. It's also, of course, about what we kind of guide readers through over the course of the page. And I will actually, here to kind of invoke this, I'm just going to read the first 65 words of my true work in progress, which I started like 3 days ago. So bear with me if I stumble into a typo, but I think we kind of see this walking through a first page in a way that I'm proud of anyway. So here it goes. It should be the easiest thing to delete this email, to flush it away with the already reads, the coupon codes, the spam. But this isn't spam, no matter what the folder might suggest. Eric, this is your father. His father. He hasn't spoken to him in years. No one has. It's rare to get a call from the dead. An email, rarer still. That's the whole first page, right? And so how does that work? Well, we have an opening line that I feel raises some questions. Why can't this email be deleted, What makes this email special? Well, we're juxtaposing it then. We're answering that question a little bit by talking about it in terms of already reads and coupon codes and spam. And then we have this word spam. We start our next sentence with, but this isn't spam. So we have a contrast. We're continuing on with the idea. And then we get into Eric, this is your father, which is part of what the email reads. Okay, we have this idea of father. We triple down on it in the next sentence. We talk about why that's important by saying our main character hasn't spoken to him in years. And then we answer the question, why hasn't he spoken to him in years? Because he's dead, allegedly. And so what we're doing in every sentence is raising a couple of questions, and then our following sentence, we're answering one or two of those questions, such that by the time we get to the end of the first page, we've built up a bond of trust, sentence to sentence, but we still have left enough unresolved that I hope anyway we'll get people wanting to read on. And that's just kind of my approach to crafting a full first page from an opening line. I don't know what you do, Angeline, but that's me anyway.
Sure, I agree. I think that, you know, the first sentence is kind of the, you know, setting it out there, your calling card. But that calling card really is, I think, the first paragraph. So if you'll indulge me, I'll do my first paragraph.
Please.
I start my day before sunrise, throwing on running clothes and laying a pinch of sema at the eastern base of a tree where sunlight will touch the tobacco first. Prayers begin with offering sema and sharing my spirit name, clan, and where I am from. I always add an extra name to make sure Creator knows who I am, a name that connects me to my father, because I began as a secret and then a scandal.
Wow, look at that.
That's the first paragraph of Firekeeper's Daughter. And, you know, hopefully, you know, people will be like, wait, what? Why?
Well, we saw again a really nice flow of one idea to the next, you know, kind of some of the notions and concepts you might have been introducing near the end of one sentence, you kind of bring back at the beginning of the next, or maybe later in that next sentence, whatever the case might be. But you're raising questions, you're answering them, and you're kind of building this nice swell of anticipation so that by the time we get to the end of that first paragraph, I'm like, all right, I have been greeted with a particular tone, a particular mood. I have a sense for this character in the world I'm about to get into, but now I still have some questions and I want to keep reading on. So I think, as in your example, just like in mine, just like in some of the others we've seen, the idea is to raise those questions and then start answering them bit by bit without giving everything away right away. At least that's kind of my takeaway from that anyway.
Sure. And what, you know, that's what Whitney was describing as a snowball. And I think that's just a great visual of this rolling down the hill and building and getting bigger. And oh, my gosh, where is it going to go? But to transition to our next question is CM Clark, at CM Clark Writer. And they ask, is opening with the weather still not a thing to do? How many of us know that it was a dark and stormy night?
Right. That's a classic. I think that's probably what's motivating this, right? It's just we're going to open with the weather and then we're going to do a zoom in kind of thing, right?
I don't even know where that started. I only know that that's what Snoopy would always start his chapter with.
Oh, that's what it is, isn't it? Oh, yeah, that's right.
Oh my God. He would. He would type on his typewriter on top of his doghouse, and that first line was always, it was a dark and stormy night.
That is funny. And, you know, the amazing thing about this question being asked is, you know, to treat the spirit of the question, I think the ultimate answer here is going to be, again, well, it depends. And I have an example of why the answer is it depends. Because for me personally, I'm not a guy who's going to open with the weather. You know, I believe in opening with character. That's always really important to me. Or opening with a strong sense of the voice of the character we're going to be with. But again, there's always an exception to the rule. And one of them comes, in fact, from a manuscript I just beta read for a fellow writer. In fact, for someone who normally participates in these RightsCast chats. But the opening line, I'm not going to read it because this is a work in progress and I didn't ask them to, but they literally in the first line poke fun at the It Was a Dark and Stormy Night opener, but not in like a mean-spirited way, but by literally invoking it as part of this like dark gothic graveyardy world that they are spinning here. So it is this sort of very self-aware kind of glib invocation here that I think really reflects the voice we're going to be with as well. So it's this idea of, yeah, I'm going to open with the weather. What's up? What are you going to do about it? Strap in, because we're about to really go hard on this just traditional gothic feel.
Hear, hear. Let's hear it for Cheeky. I love it. There's a first line from Savvy by Ingrid Law. When my brother Fish turned 13, we moved to the deepest part of inland because of the hurricane. And, of course, the fact that he'd caused it.
Wow.
I mean, all right, break the rules. Start with the weather.
Start with the weather and then get us into the fact that the weather was caused by this person. So there you have it. We're setting it up, and then we are pulling the rug out from under folks by saying, aha, I will indulge myself this breaking of a supposed rule, and I'm going to do it with a great amount of intent, which is always worth appreciating.
Exactly.
All right. So those are the questions that we had from listeners for this month's episode. Angeline, I think for you and me both, we've kind of doubled, tripled, quadrupled down on our main takeaways over the course of this episode. But why don't we just take a second now to acknowledge them again so that folks can, skip ahead to this marker in the podcast and only listen to this part. No, please don't do that. But the takeaways would be this for me anyway. You know, I think that in an opening line, whether that is for a manuscript or for a chapter, whatever the case might be, we want to be coming back to this idea of raising questions, no matter how you go about doing that. And then once we've raised those questions, we sort of snowball down our page, to borrow from Whitney's phrasing, we want to answer some of those questions while raising others, such that by the time we get to the end of a first paragraph, by the time we get to the end of a first page, we are in a position to have built trust between ourselves and between our readers. And then from there, you know, like you said earlier, Angeline, first sentences to chapters, they get easier because we have more practice, but I think also because we've built up that trust between ourselves and between readers as well. So that would be my main takeaway insofar as opening lines are concerned. But Angeline, I don't know if you have something to add or if you feel pretty similarly after this discussion here.
Oh, I agree with you. And I really liked what Whitney Hill said about snowball. I just love that visual of that first sentence and the first paragraph just kind of setting this visual in motion. And, you know, my main takeaway is always experiment with craft. Sure, there's these rules, but let's figure it out. Let's break it down. Let's try it. Just kudos to Tommy Orange for mastering the, you know, second person point of view and starting, you know, as soon as you read that first sentence in that the chapter, you're like, wait, what is this? So I just think that working on your craft and trying different things and then trusting that when it feels right, to run with it, let it snowball.
Let it snowball. That's some great advice and a really great takeaway. And with all of that said, I want to thank everyone for joining us here. As always, we're going to have opportunities for further engagement from the community. Right now, at the time of this recording anyway, people are voting on what the next topic will be for Novel Approaches when that episode debuts in April. You're choosing between mental health representation and retellings, and co-host Avery Ames will join me for that episode as my guest co-host. So folks, head to rightscast.net. By the time this episode debuts, that poll will have closed over on Twitter and Facebook, and you'll know what it is we're going to be discussing not only for our April Novel Approaches episode, but for the Rightscast chat that precedes it. And don't miss out on that chat, of course, which will take place on March 28th at 8 p.m. local time on Twitter in Sydney, London, New York City, and Denver. So as I said, thank you everyone so much for joining us for this episode of Novel Approaches here on the Rightscast Network, brought to you by Dandelion Web Marketing, the Wisconsin Writers Association, and the University of Wisconsin Writers Institute. If you liked what you heard, we'd love it if you could leave us a rating and review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts.
And for more writerly podcast content like this, visit rightscast.net or follow us on Twitter at rightscast. I'm also on Twitter as at fineangeline. Come and say hello. I'll also be at KidLitCon in Ann Arbor at the end of March. Qualey, Color of Children's Literature in New York City in April. And I will be at Book Expo of America in May in New York City. So
come say hello,
come
right?
Say hello.
Right. It's all coming back to saying hello. Very good. Well, a lot of opportunities there to meet Angeline and connect with her online as well, of course. I personally, well, I said I'll be at the UW Writers Institute at the end of March. I got plenty of other conferences coming up too, but you can find me on Twitter in the meantime as at @IamRRCampbell. And thank you to everyone who participated in our RightsCast chat on Instagram this month, including Brianna Morgan Books, Fable and the Verbivore, Maggie Smith Writes, Terrific Spec Podcast, and J.L. Henker. And I, of course, need to thank everyone who joined us for the chat over on Twitter as well, including, yes, Glenn Quigley, Jessica Payne, Mix M.A., Whitney Hill, C.M. Clark, S.J. Whitby, Jenny Worrell, Gabriella Writes, and Sarah Smith. Even if your tweet or your comment didn't make it into this episode, we really appreciate you joining us. So thanks again for that. And then next up on the RightsCast Network, we've got an episode featuring Dan Blank, who is the founder of We Grow Media. In that episode, we'll be discussing how to make authentic reader connections to forge a lasting impact. So stay tuned for that conversation, which will debut on March 20th.
And that's it for this episode of Novel Approaches. Meek Wedge, thank you for listening.
Until next time, you know what to do. Write on and write well. This is the RightsCast Network, brought to you by Dandelion Web Marketing, the Wisconsin Writers Association, and the University of Wisconsin Writers Institute, and always streaming at rightscast.net.